Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for August 18th, 2025. Tom, what do you got for us? Kick it off.
All right. So starting off this week, I have an article from Morphosec. It's titled Noodle File Stealer Evolves, Targeted Copyright Phishing Hits. Enterprises with social media footprints. So there's a newer noodle file campaign that's leveraging highly targeted spear phishing emails framed as copyright infringement notices. And it's referencing specific Facebook page IDs and company ownership details to appear legitimate and kind of pressure victims into clicking the malicious links. And it's operating across multiple regions. So we're looking at US, Europe, Baltic states, APAC, et cetera. And the attackers kind of have enhanced their credibility through AI-assisted localization, producing messages in multiple languages tailored to the regions, and kind of walking through some of what we're seeing with this. So you kind of got your malware delivery via legitimate app sideloading. So the payloads are embedded in signed applications like iHiSoft PDF Reader, Excel converters, and things like that, that are, you know, signed applications that are vulnerable to that DLL sideloading. The links are distributed via Dropbox and obfuscated with tiny URL to kind of use that methodology to attempt to bypass security checks. And from there, it would kind of cause the victims to download a zip or an MSI package containing disguised loaders. So the disguised payload components, so we're looking at archives that would hold deceptive executables masquerading as safe files. So like batch scripts named like .docx or SFX disguised as PNG and things like that. When executed, these files trigger DLL sideloading and enable persistence via registry run key updates. The payload stages additional malware from remote infrastructure as well. And then we kind of walk into some of the things we see with the C2 side. The campaign leverages Telegram groups, so the payload URLs are embedded in group descriptions. And the final stage is hosted on paste.rs. This is seemingly to try and blend in with benign like text traffic. Text sharing traffic. And the technique also adds a redundancy and stealth to kind of help avoid like really hard-coded C2s, it seems like. The capabilities and kind of some of the expansion potential. So the current build that they have, it exfiltrates credentials, cookies, especially like Facebook things, browser autofills, you know, credit card information, system info, and browsing history. But there are additional capabilities in the code base that they identified for things like key logging, screenshot capture, process monitoring, file encryption, network sniffing, things like that, that kind of suggest that future evolution and upgrades to come. But this, you know, as a note, it is an update from what Noodlefile has done. So there was a campaign back in May of this year that Noodlefile, that variant, abused or leveraged that fake AI video platform piece. So they kind of like transitioned back into more of that traditional phishing side. But, you know, there's nothing particularly novel here, Scott, but I did thought this showed some of that valuable combinations of techniques and adaptability. So you see a lot of different like kind of pivot points to try to disguise themselves. Not necessarily something we haven't seen before, but just kind of the combination of it all together was interesting to me. Leveraging AI, shifting back to more traditional phishing efforts, you know, kind of that combination and effort to leverage known applications to blend in was pretty prevalent here. But yeah, did you have any takeaways from this when you read through this one?
Yeah, I'm always curious, you know, when you look at threat actors and how they social engineer people, it's interesting because they kind of like study or hypothesize on what do people care about. And then the whole copyright thing, and then it's like associated with social media stuff, which obviously it's a space people play in, and there's more like hype as far as doing the wrong thing there that kind of gets, you know, escalated in the news and things like that. So it's kind of a good approach from a social engineering perspective to go that route. A couple like technical notes I thought that would be interesting to kind of look for. One, like obviously it looks like some of the payloads are delivered via Dropbox, but they're using URL shorteners, in this case, tiny URL. So I haven't looked at the data, but I would suspect that, you know, when you look at proxy or web logs, a lot of times one of the fields is the referrer, right? And I'm curious if you were to go to Dropbox or something from a URL shortener, would the URL shortener be in the referrer field? Not 100% on this, right? It's just kind of where my brain went when I kind of was reading through this. But that's something to think about. That might be a good way to find interesting things, because we know as security people to like be wary when you see people pulling files from Dropbox or Google Cloud or things, especially if that's not your main business way of doing things or how, what you manage and run. But knowing that it came from a URL shortener that took you to those places, you can kind of pair those two things, which can help you kind of focus in more on things that be more suspicious. So that kind of stood out to me a little bit. The other was, obviously, I love, even when things try to get tricky, you know, the persistence where they're basically putting things in the current version run keys in your registry. It's just like a, I don't think it's ever going away as long as Windows is going to be around, right? It's just a great way for things to run legitimately and manage, but it's also, you know, an easy way for adversaries to get access to stay persistent if they have no other, you know, technical means. The other thing, you know, they talk about, you know, tricking people via social engineering, but I guess some variants were actually pulled down remotely directly and then had the same persistence mechanisms, and they were actually using or leveraging curl for that. So we've talked about in the past, like, you know what the user agent looks like. You know, you'll see curl in the user agent when curl is typically being used if you have those logs, but anything going directly to IP addresses, which in this case they also were, you know, now today's day and age, people are going to actual web addresses that are like domains and names, not so much directly to IPs, especially if you're a standard user. So that always stands out to me as something to pay attention to. Trying to think, there might've been one other thing I was thinking about as I was looking through this. But yeah, those are like the key things. And like I said, a lot of the things that usually stand out or things you can look for are typically early in the attack chain in most cases, right? So that to me is always a good thing, but it's also reliable because you want to catch things as soon as possible. But also it's a great place that it's easier to get returns, because that's where I think most adversaries are the noisiest, because they're also trying to step around other tripwires to get through. So, you know, those are the big things that kind of stood out to me.
Yeah, no, that's a good wrap up. What do you got next for Scott?
All right, so I'm going to jump in on this blog from ReSecurity. They're basically, let's see, it's called Blue Locker Analysis, Ransomware Targeting Oil and Gas Sector in Pakistan. So this to me, it kind of took me back, and I'll explain why. Being the younger security analyst a long time ago, the type of security articles you would get, and I'll touch on those points. But basically, this is the Pakistan's National Cyber Emergency Response Team, the NCERT, right? They issued an advisory to 39 key ministries and institutions about this risk, because they were seeing where Blue Locker was starting to hit or target a lot of their industries, and particularly in their oil and gas sector, which is really critical to their economy as well. So it can be a big hit there. Yeah, so they kind of talk through some of the behaviors, and they try to do some attribution. But for instance, you know, they kind of talk through, oh, well, it looks like they kind of had PowerShell as a way to pull things in, right? But they didn't really show any evidence of that. And so why I say this makes me feel like an earlier analyst. I remember getting reports, and that's how attacks would be described. And it's on you to figure out, like, well, how would they do that? So, you know, as a threat hunter nowadays, you know, this isn't the end of the world. It's really good to have the examples, because it's easier to write content quick. But sometimes when you do your own research, you might actually be more thorough and finding multiple ways that you can then account for. So even if you don't cover down, because especially at the level of a ransomware group, it's not going to be usually a very tricky way. It's going to be like a standard way people use it. They might use like obfuscation, if I can get that word out. So that was an example, kind of made me think, like a callback, like, oh yeah, I got to figure out how they're going to use PowerShell download. But we've talked about that before. There's a couple different ways to use PowerShell for that. Once again, they also, I believe they use current version run keys for persistence, a common thing, right? We talked about that when it just comes to malware. And when it comes to even ransomware, the standard deleting of the shadow copies, right? And they're using WMIC or WMIC being called from CMD. So the CMD/C call method, you know, this is why I think it's important to understand just how there's so many different ransomware groups out there. So people feel like there's this huge space. But when we talk about these same techniques are being leveraged by multiple groups. So it's not like their behaviors are changing too much from group to group. Sometimes some tool sets are used differently, and depending on the type of persistence or thoroughness of their hit, like groups that try to extort more data than do ransom, they seem to be a little, have to do more technical things. But if it's just ransomware, like this kind of seems to be, a lot of the same kind of behaviors. So they called out a couple of those, you know, the typical, they'll skip certain files through the encryption process as far as what they'll target. And then they, you know, create the ransom notes. Nothing unique there. But yeah, they didn't do a very thorough job, obviously, describing every single element in the report of what or how they did it. They have a huge, you know, the MITRE menu at the bottom. So you can kind of, I guess, assume a lot of things, which I hate doing. But, you know, if there's some techniques that are, you know, very defined, sometimes, you know, you can get away with that. But yeah, the biggest things were the persistent key, the registry run key. Obviously, the shadow copy deletion kind of confirms that, you know, that, hey, this is a ransomware thing. We got to get on this. And then looking at how they're basically delivering in. Oh, I'm sorry. The one thing I didn't mention was the phishing was LNK stuff, right? They mentioned that as well. And they also said Microsoft files, but very common sending shortcut links that probably have the PowerShell command in it that's going to download and run the payload. So that's probably how that happened based on experience and seeing this stuff over and over and over again. So that's kind of something to probably pay attention to when it comes to this. But just know, like I said, these techniques are all repeatable and they're not really introducing anything that new. It's just good to be aware that this is still kind of prevalent and you should still be paying attention to those same old moves. So what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, a couple thunder points, but I don't know if you said it and you missed it, but there was the other one too, the Scott Boley special of the single character execution.
Oh no, I didn't see that
here. Yeah, it was like they ran the gamut of some of the lowest hanging fruit you would possibly see as far as like when we think about hunting nowadays.
Yeah,
but you know, kind of spot on. I think this talks to a lot of the point from a threat hunter standpoint, to where, you know, as a hunter, a lot of the times it's our job to translate the story of what happened, not just look for the code or for the techniques that were executed, but explain, like, you know, the process of how, you know, it started to finish. And we leverage tools like Killchain and MITRE and things like that to help us stay indexed appropriately. Yeah. And when you see stuff like this, like, and I don't want to pile on like it's a negative article, because I think there's definitely meat here to take from. But there is a lot of talk of certain things that they don't necessarily explain. You know, personally, me, Scott, because we see this a lot, and I love the inclusion of MITRE tactics, the MITRE attack techniques and the tactics when they table them to say, hey, these are things to consider. And they'll leave a description of kind of what it means, basically, you know, seemingly more of the MITRE subscription. But didn't you see sometimes where they will table those and they'll actually reference the actual activity in the article? Yeah, it helps you kind of understand and tell that story more. I'd love to see that be more of a common adopted thing for Intel reports, but. But yeah, beyond that, and the only complaint I have, because I get a little anxious about that when I see those MITRE tables, and it's like, okay, I look in the article to see what they're actually talking about, and I don't see any reference points.
Yeah.
So then I'm trying to generalize it myself. You know, I might leverage a MITRE, but still I'm generalizing, and I'm, you know, if I want to really stitch it to tell that story, I have a hard time, or there's a roadblock there, and that kind of, it gets frustrating.
Yeah. But I mean, that kind of is a callback to like what I was trying to reference. Like, I'm sure you remember the days where we would get a report that was released like on a Friday from whatever intel we were pending for or whatever.
Alienate Splice.
Yeah. And it was just like, here's something you should care about. And at best, we might get some IOCs to look at, but no idea the context around IOCs. And then you hear like, oh, they were using PowerShell. And you're like, how? You know, like, you know, it was like those questions. Yeah. And so you kind of had to create the narrative yourself, or you spent a long time digging to hopefully find some corroborating something. And there was usually weak links in some of those instances, but I mean, that was your job, right? So that's how challenging things I feel like were. And obviously reporting has gotten so much better, and MITRE I think has helped push a lot of that too. But yeah, so that's there when they made some mentions in there of what they did, but they didn't like show any of it. I was like, why not? You know, it's like they're giving a lot away there, or they can, even if there's things they're worried about, or you can, you know, censor it. But yeah, so not a huge dig. It just took me back.
Oh yeah, pretty. I mean, yeah, that part always got me too. Like, and I know some of the exact reports we've worked together to try to solve those problems in the past. It's like, yeah, just give me the command that was run. If you need to, you know, highlight some stuff out, that's fine. Just give me an idea of the structure so I can work from there at least. Right?
Absolutely. So what do you got next?
All right. Next article from my side. So I have something from Cisco Talos. It's titled UAT 7237 targets Taiwanese web hosting infrastructure. So we're looking at some activity reported from Talos for UAT 7237. This group, kind of a small profile on, they're identified as a Chinese speaking APT. It's been active since 2022. They are looking at a possible subgroup link to UAT 5918, mainly because they share TTPs, but with distinct operational different approaches. This new group, 7237, is focused mostly on web hosting and infrastructure providers in Taiwan, and their goal seems to be to establish long-term persistence in high-value environments. So I'm going to kind of walk through some of the key areas, the way I took my notes here for the this new group, kind of looking at, you know, the initial access piece. In this case, they've exploited unpatched internet facing servers, dropped password protected web shells for foothold, and then they installed, this is a specific key that I pulled out of this one, installed Soft Ether VPN with simplified Chinese configuration for encrypted persistent access. From the execution side, you see some things that we typically see. So you see some PowerShell web downloads. So the use of like invoke web requests or that .NET.web client to pull down their payloads. Also there's evidence of flags is included for, like, you know, use of basic parsing and out files type stuff or the dash ENC for obfuscation. But they brought something down in a custom tool for the execution side called Dub Sound Bill, and it's a loader. It's a custom loader based on VT Hello. And the decoded auxiliary file is in this case, PTITI.txt is used to launch like an arbitrary or a Cobalt Strike shellcode. And they use embedded QQ executables to act as like decoys to disguise the activity. So kind of going from there, you know, there's levels of persistence we typically see. You also get the stealth deployment of web shells, that leverage of Soft Ether VPN to kind of use to leverage that as covert access. Then there is also another tool that's leveraged. It's called Juicy Potato. So they are leveraging this for the privilege escalation side to gain system level access. And then from the credential side, they're leveraging Mimikatz or customized payloads with Mimikatz to dump LSAS memory, use a custom tool called Project 1.exe for credential harvesting. You see different things like querying registry and searching for files for, like, you know, VNC configs to extract those credentials. You also see the modification for like a wdigest downgrade attack where they're modifying that current control set, control security providers, wdigest, and specifically talking about the user logon credential value. Then in the discovery side, this is also something I think we've talked about this before, but when you kind of see this, like, excessive kind of discovery command. So when you see in your logs, like a batch run of, like, you know, you see system info, IP config, task list, who am I, NS lookup, you see all these things kind of be running consecutively, kind of an easy flag. There also was some discussion of the use of fscan for internal subnet scanning and network mapping. And then on the kind of pivoting or lateral movement side, there was evidence where they performed SMB kind of brute force attempts or propagation or leveraging SMB shares, as well as some WMI usage, specifically with two tools, Sharp WMI and WMI command, to kind of help with remote execution across those systems. And then some of the other things that we see kind of more on the evasion side is one specifically is they were disabling remote UAC restrictions. I think mostly to simplify that lateral movement, but this is mainly seen, and we've definitely discussed this in the past. God, I can't remember specifically when, but the modification of that that Windows current version policies system where you are specifically talking about the value of that key for the local account token filter policy. But yeah, you know, there's a lot here, Scott. I went through a bunch. This was a pretty big article, a lot of meat here. Specifically though, some of the callouts that I think I mentioned when it comes to like the kind of the more the threat hunting targeting side, looking for those SMB share amounts, that's something that like you should be able to really easily normalize in your environment or call out if it's anomalous. One of the things we talk about quite a bit is that, you know, the various ways to leverage PowerShell to download files from the internet. So in this specific case, an example they give is that a PowerShell call to that system.net.web client download file. The Windows discovery thing, as I mentioned, that's a pretty easy flag when you're looking at like excessive variations of those calls for those things like QMI, system info, and all that. The registry edits specifically focusing around disabling the UAC that I had mentioned, as well as the WDigest downgrade. So those are two pretty low hanging pieces of fruit, but that's just to name a few. Again, there was a lot in this one, but I'll take a breath, Scott, toss it over to you, see if you had any thoughts that I didn't cover on.
No, I thought, you know, Talos uses a pretty good write up from the technical side as far as what activity is going on. And, you know, we mentioned like we want to see command lines. They did a really good job of capturing most, if not all, the command lines they wanted to share, but in a way and grouped them together. So it's really easy to kind of understand. But it's a great place to go look at what was being run and understand by command line. Like, well, what does this do if you don't already know? Because being aware of that, one, helps you identify, hey, this is suspicious in some ways, but also sometimes you also learn how to do things better on your own job, because from the attackers, like, oh, I didn't know you could get information that way. That could be helpful in other ways. So that part's cool. But the one thing I wanted to call out that is just all over this is how some of the commands are being run. So they kind of walk through, they talked about earlier on how they're putting either getting access via web shells and then, you know, putting in basically some persistent backdoors potentially. So when you kind of have an implant or a web shell, a lot of times you're using the operating system to run your commands, but not like some like hook way where you're doing like API calls a lot of times. A lot of times you're just like what they did here is they're running, you know, command prompt CND with the slash C flag to pass whatever argument or things they want to actually execute with the command prompt. So almost all their commands are CND slash C. So that in itself is kind of telling when you see multiple instances of command C or command prompt being run, but you also can see the arguments with a slash C. And if they're all coming from the same executable or same process, can be very suspicious. It very indicative of a potential web shell if it's a web server, and that probably wouldn't be normal activity altogether. But if there's an implant on the system, that is a common way where things can kind of be run. You can see the implants kind of varied a little later when you saw some things where some commands were being run with a dash C, but they didn't mention COBOL. I don't remember if that's exactly how that works, but either way, like it's good to pay attention to those types of things. Like, how are things being passed and potentially why? Is it associated with a specific tool or malware and how it's supposed to look? Or is it just, hey, we know whatever this is can call a process and the only thing it can really execute is using something on the system to execute it, is sometimes a telltale sign. So that was a big thing. Obviously, there's a lot of things to dig into. If I go like, you know, line by line, technique by technique on this one, I think it's good for people to actually go visit and look at this and see. It'd be a good test for someone to look at the commands and say, I know what this is, and see how much they actually know versus this looks like it's new. Because a lot of the stuff to me, doing this long, I'll probably say like, you know, 95% of this or so, I am very familiar with everything they're doing here, and I've seen it before. And it's, I think these types of reports are good to kind of almost validate where you sit, right? Is this really common to you, or is this net new? And if it's net new, it's a great place to learn some new things. So, but yeah, the way things execute on this one was what stood out the most. But there's easily good things to be looking for or paying attention to.
Yeah, nothing big to add on that one. But yeah, for me, that this report, when we're talking about report structure, and you mentioned it, so I'm just doing a double agree here, but it makes my brain happy when you see it kind of laid out this way, where they break out the commands, they give you kind of code block, and they let you see how it's being run. It's easy to understand and kind of translate to the point of what it was trying to accomplish. So good on Talos on this one for sure. And yeah. So what do you got last for, Scott?
So this one was just kind of interesting because of the artifacts that were discussed in here. And it is a secure list article called Evolution of Pipe Magic Backdoor from the Ransom X Incident to CVE-2025-29824. So Microsoft, they patched a bunch of vulnerabilities, right? And one of the things that were patched was a vulnerability that was exploited for using the Pipe Magic malware, which is actually first discovered December 2022 in a Ransom X ransomware campaign. And it kind of keeps coming up. So the most recently here now, it was used to infect organizations in Brazil and the Middle East. But, interestingly enough, this was first detected in December of 2022, but is attacking an exploit or using an exploit for a 2017 vulnerability. And it was using a backdoor loader that was basically Trojanized. It was a version of Rufus, which is a utility for formatting USB drives. And Pipe Magic has two modes of operation, depending on how it gets deployed. It's either a full-fledged backdoor that gives you remote access, or it's kind of like a network gateway, which kind of enables execution of a bunch of different commands, depending on what it is you're trying to do. So they kind of walk through some of the payloads and use ChatGPT as an example of a way to kind of trick people into it. And that was like the earlier payloads, but then they even compared some of the signature-based things associated with the Pipe Magic in 2025. And this one's interesting because they paid a lot of attention to the named pipes that were being created. So I guess I really didn't prepare myself well to talk about named pipes in the most detailed fashion, but essentially in a system, you can create a pipe, and it's a way to pass information to a process, right? So it's kind of like, if you think about passing things over a network via like IP, a named pipe is like, hey, if you want to talk to this process in this way, you can, kind of hit the pipe internally, and that's how you can pass information. So the earlier version of the name pipe or Pipe Magic pipe was a one dot, and then it was like a 16 byte array hex string, right? That was the name of the pipe. And if you ever have data that or you have telemetry that captures named pipes when they get created or leveraged, usually the names make sense. So that's something to just note. Like if you're looking at name pipe data and you see like random looking names, those oftentimes aren't normal and they're worth looking into. And a lot of times in that telemetry, you can see what created the pipe, so they can kind of go down that way. But what's interesting is it created that pipe 2017. No big deal. I kind of use it for some of the transmit encrypted payload stuff. But the standard network interface that it used to actually talk to that name pipe, it actually used a loopback address. So it went to the 127.0.0.1, but on port 8082. That was kind of how it interacted with that pipe in a weird way. But one of the C2 servers that actually downloaded modules, because Pipe Magic can have modules, was something hosted in Azure, right? So it was like a bunch of A's followed by a bunch of B's in the East US cloud app azure.com. And they were able to kind of use that because that C2 server was reused. So that part's kind of crazy, right? Like this is usually you don't see, especially domain-based stuff, reused. But maybe enough time has passed. But basically they saw the same Azure with the, it was like 5A's, 6B's or something like that in the furthest subpart of the domain. So that part was all kind of interesting, and they kind of talk through the different versions and payloads and show examples of some of the code to try to make some of the comparisons, which was interesting. And then they mentioned some of the other pipes that were being made from the later versions. And what's interesting there is it, like an example here, a pipe that's created is called Magic 3301, less weird from a naming convention. Like if you're looking at things that really stand out, but it's still kind of weird because it doesn't seem very system specific. But ironically, they're still using the same loopback address, an 8082 port, to kind of converse with that. And it sounds like they even create these pipes and not really explicitly use them. So that part is also interesting, but you know, that is what it is. So they, you know, they talk about some of the modules that can be loaded in, where it can initialize and create threads, terminate plugins, process input, output, you know, file operations, those types of things, open and read files. Then, you know, they talk about even the loader module. It also creates a pipe. And the example of the name pipe there is test_pipe 20. And then it passes what looks like our random digits after that. So, you know, very interesting to kind of see the way that there's all these pipes being created as part of this. And so, like I said, if you had that telemetry, because they even go into like the injector part, it creates a pipe and it's just a random number string, right? So sometimes it's hard to, like, I guess, create content for looking for randomness potentially, right? But you may be able to do things based on rarity, because if a lot of the endpoints in your environment are running the same stuff, there's a good chance that the pipes that are being created are relatively the same too. So you can kind of look for rare instances of what name pipes are, you know, being leveraged there. But some of the post exploitation they did as well, that looks like they were renaming, or they maybe injected into dll host.exe. Because when they were actually running it, it looked like they were calling the system32 version of it. But either way, the commands that were passed looked more like proc dump, where it's basically accepting the EULA, which is common with any of the, SysMon, but I'm trying to think of the utilities of that whole suite of things. That'll come to me in a minute. But basically the arguments that you use to dump the process, and they're dumping the LSAS, which is very common to basically try to extract creds. But the interesting thing here is dll host.exe is not a Windows executable that supports any command line flags, right? And I think I even did something similar to this, looking at, you know, when people hollow out processes. Because if you hollow out a process and inject into it, and it's a process that doesn't support command line flags, then obviously that's very suspicious. You're starting to see all this command line activity on a process that isn't designed for that. So I think I even created a hump pack specifically for that and had to go through research all the bins in system32 and sysfile64 to say which ones take arguments, which ones don't. I kind of make that, but that's a good approach. And they call it out here, and I think it's a great call out, because it's a great way to find definitely the post exploitation stuff for, and it looks like my guess is they hollowed it out. Right. But there's one other command line thing I thought I saw in here, where basically when it was trying to run the help installer, cause it used a MS build. That was the other thing. And I lost my place in here where I saw that. But from memory, if I remember it correctly, oh, here it is. Yeah. So they basically ran, CMD, right? But they're using a slash K. And if I remember, slash K is like the background. So it's just some kind of pop up in foreground, but they basically use MS build to, build the file, which they, it was like a Microsoft help index file to build a payload, and it helps them execute that payload. So that's something that I don't expect to see a lot, but I don't really look at that process. But that's another way to potentially look on the beginning of the attack chain, potentially, right, of where things are getting possibly delivered in some way, but then they have to like build their payload after the fact, which helps bypass actually a lot of defenses when you can build things and compile things on the system directly. So yeah, the MS build activity, building a MSHI file is kind of how they did it, but maybe looking at that activity as well is a good thing to kind of dial in on. But yeah, so like I said, it's interesting because there's a lot of like kind of IOC specific stuff when they talk about the name pipes. A lot of people don't look at name pipes. Sometimes it's really hard to build content off name pipes, partly because not every tool gives you that telemetry or they don't expose all of it. but it's good to know that it exists and why it exists and things to consider there as far as your strategy. But like I said, there's some other things that we look for as well. So yeah, I don't know what you thought primarily about this or what you learned or took away.
Yeah, more to kind of expand on a bit to kind of carry on what you're saying. Like, I remember, like, kind of when I started looking for name pipes and kind of, it's not something that's it's blatantly obvious, right? It's not just like living in your general logging. So, you know, some things to note on what you'd be wanting to consider to be able to identify name pipes in your environment. So definitely from the sysmon side. So event ID 17, I believe, is specifically you can track the name pipe creation. I also think there's value in the event and the network connection attempts. Or the connection attempts, that's event 18, event ID 18. Some EDR tools do name pipes now. I think I picked up on that a little more. Not to the full depth that like you get from a sysvon event from my experience, but at least partial to where you can identify that happening. I'm looking through some of my notes from name pipe stuff because I feel like it's worth mentioning because I don't know how many folks are maybe hitting that or not thinking about tracking name pipes.
Yeah, because a Cobalt Strike, that was like a big thing about its beacons, was it would create specific name pipes, one that you could fingerprint, and they could change them, but they obviously were typically weird names as well.
So kind of an oddball standout. So Windows Event ID 5145, so that's like it logs access attempts to name pipes via SCP shares. That's kind of an oddball standout. Also on the Linux side, because we tend to talk about Windows a lot, but you can leverage Audit D to track name pipes, you know, kind of by tracking mknod system calls and then the exec VE are like the for the like command line side patterns. So those are just some things to consider if you're wanting to make sure you can see and or log name pipes. But from the Windows side, sysmon's your best bet. It's going to give you the most meat. But
yeah, and on that note, like logging name pipes can be tricky because it can be very verbose if you said, give me everything. And I have in the past said, like, well, give me everything that's not in the program folders or the system32 syswap folders outside of that. So I see the name pipes of anything being created that's like kind of in a non-traditional place as I think a decent first approach. But if I'm not sure in an instance where if a normal process like system32 process gets hollowed out and injected into and then name pipes get created, how that will get handled. Obviously, if it looks at it as that process at that location, then it's not going to get logged with the way at the rule set I'm describing. So, you know, just be aware that there can be some blind spots in some types of instances, but if the log level is low, really low from doing what I described, it's worth doing just to have that extra visibility for those other nuanced things. But yeah, no, I agree fully. All right. So yeah, I think before we close out, just want to mention that we are going to have our next live podcast September 11th, where we do interactive, you know, live at Discord, live on video discussing things. And we're going to get more into some of the AI talk stuff that we kind of broached on the last live episode that we got a lot of positive feedback, but we have a lot more to talk on that front and bring to the table. And we're kind of curious other people's thoughts on that as well, because it's a hot topic that people have very strong opinions about. So sometimes interesting things come out. So definitely participate, partake if you can. If not, it might be a good listen later. So pay attention to that. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Throw Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top throw hunting headlines for the week of August 18th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.